Welcome to Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia. My name is Lewis Rainey. Soundboard airs every Saturday at 6 a.m. on WTJU 91.1 FM and also podcasting as part of the Teej FM network. That's TEEJ.FM. Tune in, subscribe, and find out what's happening in your community and around the state. Later in the show, we'll talk to Richmond-based journalist Peter Galaska about Virginia politics, but right now, we're joined here in the studio by Giles Morris. He's the executive director at Charlottesville Tomorrow, as well as Emily Hayes, news reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. So thank you both for joining us today. We're talking about, as we do every couple years, the comprehensive plan. For those who follow, you know, city politics, county politics, this is obviously nothing new, but there are a lot of people who hear the phrase and immediately tune out. Can you give us a rundown of not just what it is, but why we all should be paying attention?
So the comprehensive plan is a way of setting out the city's vision, or the county's vision, if we're talking about that. But right now we're talking about the Charlottesville comprehensive plan. And that gives you everything from transportation plans to housing plans. What do we want our city to look like, and what kind of services are we providing to our community?
The comprehensive plan, it's not like necessarily a blueprint, right? It's about planning, which is a profession in local government. But the comprehensive plan connects those basic nuts and bolts planning conversations that involve things like building permits and zoning laws and restrictions to bigger picture values, intents, and forward-looking ideas about bigger topics like density, affordability, fairness.
I think that's one of the most interesting things I've seen over the years in Charlottesville and in these conversations. When we talk about the comprehensive plan, that really does say a lot about where the city and its people are, what they're concerned about, what they're focused on, what they're looking for in the future. Where are we right now with this comprehensive plan?
So it was almost complete in December. There was a draft of every chapter except for two were still being finalized, but those two are proving pretty difficult. And there was a work session early January that even maybe backpedaled some of the work that they'd done in November.
What are the chapters that are missing?
So the two that are most sort of tricky at this point are the community engagement chapter, which is actually a new chapter that Charlottesville has never done before, and the land use chapter, which is becoming sort of a way to talk about affordability in Charlottesville. It's really been a focus for a lot of activists who over 2 years, the 2 years that this is being edited, have repeatedly called for more community engagement from, marginalized communities. So the land use chapter is looking at what will our city look like? Where do we want tall buildings? What do we want these established single-family neighborhoods to look like? And can we change that to allow more affordable housing in the city?
And I would just say, to cut straight to the point, I mean, the city of Charlottesville on its north side is essentially zoned residential for leafy, quaint neighborhoods of homes. And that has traditionally been the white, affluent side of town. And the south side of town has had many more mixed uses, mixed
uses,
permissions, commercial and industrial development, and its neighborhoods have been sort of the ones carrying the brunt of the city's focus on increasing density. So there's this kind of social justice equity subject of like, why do our neighborhoods that are always the ones that, you know, sort of catch the blunt force of economic changes are now supposed to also be the solution to Charlottesville's affordable housing crisis or its community redesign around density or transportation? You know, can't we make that more equitable so that all parts of town share those burdens more equally?
Well, then when those arguments have come up, what has been the response? What is the back and forth that's going on right now that is preventing sort of this portion of it from moving forward?
I think there is a fair amount of agreement among current planning commissioners that the way to reverse some of those trends is to allow these single family neighborhoods to now have multifamily, you know, apartments that are sort of small scale. They kind of look like houses, but so that is the way to allow more housing in Charlottesville. I think they're on agreement with that. It comes down to really a question of what do you want Charlottesville to be, especially in terms of how much growth are we looking at? How many people will we be able to handle with our current infrastructure? And or are we looking to invest a lot more in infrastructure to allow the population to grow? So that's where you get some tension between different planning commissioners, who some really want, like, go as high as you want, you know, in the dense corridors that we're talking about, like, you know, allow the free market to do its work. And then some others are like, no, I've lived here my whole life. I, you know, have my home and my neighborhood that I love, and I think that needs to be preserved. Even if we allow more density, it should not look so different.
Are we in that tension, that back and forth? Does it look like there's a way moving forward, or right now are those two sides kind of at an impasse about about these two visions of Charlottesville and land use?
You know, from my perspective, Emily's followed these processes really closely. And if you want to really dig in, please go to seavilletomorrow.org and read Emily's stories following the Housing Advisory Committee and some of the other bodies that have been assembled to help the planning commissioners and the city council think this through thoroughly. But watching from the outside and having seen this process evolve, really, you know, our city shifted in its whole mindset after August 11, 12, 2017. And a lot of these processes were already in play. And then you had a year of, you know, very chaotic city government in which people were still just trying to figure out how are you going to put the pieces back together and move a plan like this forward. But you had people, planning commission members who were long serving, certain city councilors who had, like Kathy Galvin, who had been incredibly involved in comprehensive planning processes and incredibly focused on getting this comprehensive plan done. I mean, we haven't had a new comprehensive plan to set the main parameters for how the city is going to look at development since the early 2000s. Well, the city has changed radically over that period. So people were really anxious to get new rules in place, new rules for developers, period, around density, around a strategic investment area, all these sort of nerdy, big picture approaches to making a more dense, more walkable, more viable, more affordable city. But they hadn't really engaged the equity conversation or the racial justice piece or directly with activist groups or the redevelopment of public housing and subsidized housing. So really, to me, what's happened in the last year is that has been a lot of the meat of the work, and that's still where most of the sticking points are in the details of how that stuff gets hammered out.
Is that also where the community engagement portion comes in? Is that sort of a reaction to what we've seen from August 2017?
Absolutely. Actually, the first meeting after August 12, 2017 was a planning commission meeting that got shut down by activists who were so, you know, distraught about what had happened in the city and saying, how are we developing a comprehensive plan like we've been talking about that potentially continues to affect marginalized communities more than anyone else, but not include their voice as a central piece?
And then in the plan, then you get to the tension of how do you execute the plan? People have to think long term about that. And so then there's this give and take between, well, how much revenue are we getting from development and commercial development? How are we incentivizing that revenue if we're going to use new revenues to be more equitable or to be more aggressive around affordable housing. And so then you get people who sort of, I mean, it really gets down to like, you know, you're a capitalist, you're a socialist, you know, like, wait, what are we trying to solve here? And how can we find a common ground that we agree on, that we trust as we move forward? And that, I think, is you know, where the rubber hits the road in these conversations, because trust is at the foundation of all of these types of conversations. That gives you the flexibility to be big picture, to be longer term thinkers. But if it's not there, you know, it's like, hey, what do you got for us? And how are you going to show us that you're actually going to follow through? The development community in Charlottesville has been a little bit frozen. They're not sure how to participate in what's good. They're also not sure to what extent their business models and economic models will fit with the rules that come down. And so there's a lot of tension. And so the West Second project falling through was a great example of where the expectations, the changed expectations in the city and its government really played out in a planning process that derailed a very expensive plan. It might have been exactly the right thing to happen for the city, but it was certainly painful for all the people involved. There was a lot of money at stake, years and years of work, and a lot of the people in the development community sat back after that and said, look, you know, we have by right development rights. We can build what we can build now. We're not going to engage in a high-risk, long-term political process without knowing what's going to happen. And so, you know, a lot of planning and development is carrot and stick. What incentives do you give to people to do the things you want them to do? And what stick do you use to keep them from doing things you don't want to do? And those are rules get written into the comprehensive plan. And I think everyone is dying for some resolution to that. And so we look forward to seeing that. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, it's the last 5% of a plan like this can take a long time, right? Because it's that piece of closing the book and saying, this is where we are, we're moving forward with this. Even though most planners will say, there's still so much that gets hammered out practically, project by project. And that's going to teach us a lot about where this plan is going once it's adopted. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I would say one of the pieces that has to be hammered out that like really sets the rules is Charlottesville zoning, that has a lot of sort of wonky, contradictory rules within it. And the Planning Commission wants to do a rezoning after they do the comprehensive plan, which is part of why there's so much at stake in the land use map, because that will be sort of the blue, some sort of big picture version of what the zoning might look like. So that's why it's so much at stake in this conversation.
Well, with so much still ongoing in the discussion and so many details still to work out, two questions. The first is just what are we looking towards next? What are the next big milestones that people should be looking out for, be engaged with? And then how can people keep up with everything?
I think there will be more work sessions. I don't think they've been scheduled yet, but the Planning Commission is going to keep meeting until they hammer it out. And you can follow my coverage of that and Charlottesville Tomorrow's coverage at cvilletomorrow.org.
Emily, when do you think we will have a new comprehensive plan to unveil to the city of Charlottesville?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to be optimistic and say in 1 month. I don't think that's going to happen, though.
But presumably, people are really focused on getting this done in the spring. I mean, that's how they've all talked about it.
Right. I think if they've been talking about doing some one-on-one conversations to build that trust that we were talking about. And I think if that happens, it could happen.
Giles Morris is the executive director, and Emily Hayes is a news reporter at Charlottesville Tomorrow. Find out more and read the latest at charlottesvilletomorrow.org. You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the TEEJ FM network, TEEJ.FM. WTJU and TEEJ FM are both a service of the University of Virginia. Opinions expressed on this show are, of course, just that, opinions, not the positions of the University of Virginia. We turn now to our regular correspondent on state news and politics, Peter Galaska. He's a journalist based in the Richmond area. Peter, there's a ton of stuff happening in the General Assembly, as you would expect. One of the big ones is the Equal Rights Amendment that was approved by the Virginia Senate this week. But how are things looking in the House of Delegates?
Well, there's a problem with that. It's a very interesting development, and it could be a very historical one, because if Virginia were to ratify ERA, it would be the 38th state to do so, which means that ERA would become the law of the land. And that's really putting Virginia at a tipping point. Well, the Senate voted to approve it this past week, and a number of Republicans actually voted for it. The problem is it has to go to the House of Delegates, which is, of course, controlled by Republicans. And this is like the fifth time this has happened, where the Senate has approved ERA, and then the House of Delegates have shot it down. Usually they kill it in committee, so it never really gets to a vote. There's a good chance that will happen in this case. Now, some of the mitigating factors are that a lot of people who were really stridently opposed to ERA, like Bob Marshall, is no longer in office. And these are people who are social conservatives who believe that the ERA would make it much easier for people to get abortions and the like. But, you know, who knows? Things might be changing. I mean, the state's becoming more blue as we speak.
Now, can I ask you a little bit about some of the opposition? I've heard the opposition cite the abortions, as you mentioned, but also that the bill is defunct. Can you give me a quick rundown on what they mean when they say the bill is defunct?
Well, that's kind of hard to say. I mean, what does defunct mean? The fact is that ERA had its roots in the 1960s with the rise of the feminist movement. And I believe that Congress passed it in 1972, which is a long time ago. And so it got, you know, I think the deadline for it to be passed was 82, although there can be changes made. And it didn't. It wasn't ratified by enough states. So they're saying that it's an old bill. It's kind of no longer needed. And that, you know, women have, you know, part of the argument would go the narrative that women have already accelerated past a glass ceiling on salaries. Whether that's true, I kind of doubt. But anyway, that's sort of what they mean. Defunct means kind of, it's kind of amorphous what it really means.
Now, as we go into the House of Delegates, and what are we looking at? Are there any key players or?
Not specifically. The thing is that it's typical in Virginia. The old Virginia way to kill progressive legislation was not to have a big dramatic vote, but to kill it in committee. And the House of Delegates is just notorious for that. So that's what I think is going to happen. And as I say, even though the Senate, once again, this is the fifth time the Senate's ratified it, but if, you know, it goes to committee, it goes to the usual death route, then it's dead. Although it could change next year, depending on how elections go, if a lot of Democrats win in the fall, because, you know, the whole General Assembly's up for grabs this November, then maybe it will pave the way for something next year.
Right. Now, another really big topic, of course, is the minimum wage bill, and that made it out of committee and is headed to the Senate floor.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, basically what that means is that the Senate's Commerce and Labor Committee moved to raise the minimum wage in the state from, what, $7.25 to $15 an hour. And it even got votes from traditional conservatives such as Tommy Norment and Wolf, and Frank Wolf and others. And so That could very well, you know, die a committee death when it goes to the House of Delegates. But it is an interesting bill. It kind of shows that Virginia may be modernizing.
Is it too much to look at the Republicans who voted for this bill on the Senate side and see if that is representative of all of how the House of Delegates might act? I don't think there's any correlation,
okay. Really. I just think that, you know, once again, You've got a number of things. You've kind of got several different arguments going here. For example, if you're in Northern Virginia, where the cost of livings are high, bringing the minimum wage to $15, it really does make sense because it just recognizes the reality of it. Now, the arguments for the anti-minimum wage raise people would say if you go to a place like Southwest Virginia or Southside Virginia, where the industries have been decimated, be it, you know, coal or furniture or textiles, that a lot of employers aren't going to be able to afford a $15 minimum wage. And there's some arguments that say that the minimum wage should be set by a local basis to better serve the realities or meet the realities, the economic realities of, say, somebody out in Dickinson County in the far southwest compared to, say, Arlington or Fairfax. So that's what the argument could be. Let's not do it on a state basis because it's a huge state, actually. and let's do it on a local basis.
Now, in addition to both the minimum wage, the ERA, LGBTQ rights have been been before the General Assembly. The Senate over the last couple of years has pushed for expanding, increasing protections, but those measures, like we've talked about with some of the other issues, have stalled in the House.
Yeah.
It sounds like, and I want to get your take, it seems like there's some Republicans now, Republican delegates, who are coming out in support of a recent bill.
Yeah, one of them is from my home county of Chesterfield. Delegate Roxanne Robinson has, joined the effort to pass a non-discrimination law to protecting lesbian, gays, and others, especially in the area of housing. Now, this, once again, is part of a trend that's growing. Whether it's going to be significant and decisive, we don't know. But obviously, when you look at the past elections, more centrist to center-left people have been winning, notably in the congressional elections of the past last year. And this has a big influence. And meanwhile, you're seeing a lot of the old, social conservatives, like, Bob Marshall's not there anymore. Dick Black from up in the Loudoun area, who's a very strong social conservative, he's still in power, but he's not going to run for re-election. And you're seeing kind of a new, like Monica Rehm from Prince William area, who's transgender. She's in power. She actually beat Bob Marshall. So this is having an influence. Now, whether it's going to be significant this specific year remains to be seen. Once again, as we just said, this could set the agenda and the arguments and the discussion for next year, depending on how elections in the fall go.
I wanted to shift gears a little bit. The New York Times recently profiled a member of the House of Delegates, Lee Carter. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, they did. Lee Carter is what you call a self-styled social democrat. And he's really kind of interesting because he's, once again, kind of an anomaly. And Virginia has been, the argument that the Times brought up, well, not the argument, the situation was that, as you know, that Virginia has always been, both Democrats and Republicans have been very pro-business. And what they do is they offer goodies to businesses trying to locate here that they think are good businesses for the state. An example is Micron, which is a chip maker that's going to expand in Manassas. And, of course, the big enchilada is Amazon, which is moving near D.C. just across the river, and it's getting like $500 million and more in aid from the state. And, Amazon is huge. So Lee Carter is saying, wait a minute, why are we giving all this, welfare to these big, rich corporations? They did for Micron, they did for Amazon, and they've done it, frankly, for other firms throughout the state, too. And he's raising questions about that and just saying, why are we doing this? Which is really goes against what both parties have been advocating for years.
Peter, I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the shutdown for at least a minute. It's, as of recording, it's still going on. What is its effects on both Virginia and Virginia workers?
Well, Forbes magazine had a pretty interesting take on it. It just goes over pretty much common sense stuff that you probably already knew, that there are many, many people in the country, and especially in Virginia, who have federal jobs. And when they're not getting paid, a lot of stuff does not happen. They can't pay their mortgages. They can't pay their credit cards. They can't pay their student loans. They can't hire other people. So there's a trickle-down effect into the economy, a negative one. And so that's basically what it means. As this goes on, it's going to impact the state seriously. And as time goes on, it's going to get worse and worse.
Peter, in the news that I've been seeing, it in the polls that I've been seeing, it seems like more blame right now is going towards the president than towards the Democrats. Do you have any sense on whether Virginia follows that trend, or if there's anything to suggest how Virginians, where Virginians are placing that blame, or the majority of them are placing that blame for the shutdown?
Well, I would think that it depends on where you are in the state. If you're from Northern Virginia, you're probably going to blame Trump. If you're from out in the mountains or rural areas, you probably are less inclined to do so. It's been a really tough battle with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, fighting Trump over this wall and funding for which it's not really clear what he wants, whether it's a real wall or what it is. And so, I don't know, people are just going to ride through it, and it's really unfortunate when you have the Coast Guard being told to hold yard sales because they're not getting paid, and it's just sort of bizarre.
Peter Galaska, he's a journalist based in the Richmond area.
You're listening to Soundboard here on WTJU 91.1 FM and the Teej FM network, TEEJ.FM. WTJU is supported by the Southern Environmental Law Center, celebrating 30 years of protecting the South's environment and the people who depend on it for health and well-being. Power of the Law, Southern Environmental Law Center.
Andrew Carl is a UVA history professor, focusing on the history of land use and racial inequality. He led a class on local political engagement in Charlottesville in fall 2017, just after the events of August 11th and 12th.
I grew up in a small community where both of my parents at different times in their lives ran for city council. One of my earliest memories as a kid was, you know, going and putting signs in people's yards, you know, for my father when he was running for city council. So I kind of grew up in an environment where where it was understood that it was important to remain civically engaged. And two, if you cared about issues, if you wanted to see your community improve, then you need to make your voice heard and you need to step out and take chances. Not be afraid to, you know, run and lose in an election. And my parents, being both Democrats in a heavily Republican town, we saw many losses. But, you know, it wasn't discouraging. It was something, again, that you needed to have a debate and you needed to make the issues heard. And again, if you don't win the election, that doesn't mean that it was wasted effort at all. And so I kind of understood that from a young age, how important that was.
To find out more, visit engagedUVA.virginia.edu. This is WTJU, Charlottesville.
Vikram Joswell is an associate professor in psychology at the University of Virginia. His research and teaching focus on communication and autism. We spoke to him as part of the Engaged UVA interview series.
So one of the stereotypes of autistic people is that they're not interested in interacting with other people. They are, in the language that often gets used in the literature, it's that they lack social motivation or they're not motivated to interact with other people. They're just not interested in people. But in the time that I've spent with autistic people, it's pretty clear that most of the folks that I know are craving interaction, and they are pretty disappointed and discouraged when their overtures or their attempts to engage with other people are ignored or are misunderstood. Autism is characterized by a number of atypical behaviors, so behaviors that people who are not autistic don't engage in. And these behaviors on the surface to somebody who's not expecting them may appear to indicate that the person is not interested. So just to take eye contact as an example, in Western cultures, we do place a lot of emphasis on eye contact, and we expect that when somebody is interested in a conversation or is interested in engaging with us in some way, that they'll look us in the eye. Maybe not stare at us, of course, but autistic people often don't do this. And there are lots of explanations, but if you actually ask autistic people, you get a range of responses. Some of them are things like, for example, well, when I'm not looking at you, I'm just concentrating on what you're saying, and it's easier for me to process the information when I'm not looking at you, because your face and your eyes are giving me all kinds of information that if I want to pay attention to your verbal message, I need to tune out. You know, I think one of the problems with a condition like autism is society's expectations and beliefs and stereotypes and oftentimes incorrect assumptions about autism and autistic people. And so if we can help to break down some of those mistaken assumptions, encourage people to couch things in a more positive way and to see that, you know, as things are not always what they seem. Just because somebody doesn't look at you, just because they're repeating something back to you, doesn't necessarily mean anything about their interest in you or their desire to interact with you. I mean, I think that's a fundamental thing that all humans share, and that's a desire for social connection.
Vikram Joswell is an associate professor in psychology at UVA. To hear more Engaged UVA stories, visit engagedUVA.virginia.edu. And that does it for this week's edition of Soundboard, your source for news, culture, and community issues in Central Virginia. My name is Lewis Reining. Our theme song is Kyoja Beat by Marwin Alasco and Jay Pun. This is Soundboard. Catch us at WTJU.net or our podcast home at Teej FM. That's TEEJ.FM. Have a great week.